Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, podcasting to you as usual from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. Today is the 23rd of April 2015 and I'm delighted to welcome back to the programme Patrick Wood, who joined us last year to talk about the Trilateral Commission and its vision for a new economic world order. Patrick Wood is an author and lecturer who has studied elite globalisation policy since the late 1970s when he partnered with the late Anthony C. Sutton to co-author Trilaterals Over Washington, Volumes 1 and 2. He is a leading expert on the elitist Trilateral Commission, their policies and achievements in creating their self-proclaimed new international economic order. An economist by education, a financial analyst and writer by profession, and an American constitutionalist by choice, Patrick Wood maintains a biblical worldview and has deep historical insights into the modern attacks on sovereignty, property rights, and personal freedom. Such attacks are epitomized by the implementation of UN policies such as Agenda 21, sustainable development, smart growth, and in education, the widespread adoption of Common Core. He is a frequent speaker and guest on radio shows around the US and indeed internationally. His current research builds on Trilateral Commission hegemony, focusing on transhumanism, technocracy, and scientism, and how these are co-opting economics, politics, and religion around the world. Pat, thank you very much indeed for joining us again on The Mind Renewed.
Oh, it's great to be back, Julian. Thanks for having me back.
It's really great to be speaking with you again. Now, the subject of the conversation today, which will be very much related to the conversation we had last time on the Trilateral Commission, is going to be your new book, which you published this year, called Technocracy Rising, the Trojan Horse of Global Transformation, which I have to say is a fascinating read. I think it's a really, really important book. And I'm going to say, I think everybody absolutely has to take time to read this, get this book and read it, because I think it's really very important. I mean, it's one of these cliches, isn't it, that said that, you know, a book joins up the dots, but this one really does. So first question really, Pat, is to ask you, how's the book doing in terms of sales?
Well, I wish it was doing better, honestly, but then I probably would say that no matter how many books we were selling. I would have expected some more sales than what we've had, but the response has been fantastic. For people that are reading the book, I mean, it's just over the top. You know, you look on Amazon.com, and I think there's 34 or 5 reviews on there now. There's one 4-star review, and all the rest of them are 5 stars all the way down the line. And, you know, the statements like, if you only read one book this year, this has to be it. Some people are saying this is the book, you know, for the fate of the future. It's just, you know, and I don't write those kind of reviews. I'm just saying what other people are saying about the book. You would think with that kind of, you know, enthusiasm that more people would want to get a hold of it and read it. You know, I think there's some reasons maybe why, not just politics crowding out mindshare, but there might be a measure of fear as well. You know, people hear me on the radio, they hear me on TV or something, and they listen, they nod their head, they understand, say, that's fantastic. And then they say, man, I don't want to know anymore.
I guess one of the things must be that there are so many books about which a lot of hype is created. And, you know, every book that's out there, you know, it says, oh, this is, you've got to read this. It's going to change your way of looking at the world. And when it comes to a book that actually is going to do something along those lines, people perhaps don't believe it.
Well, we'll see how it turns out. Sales have been picking up as people talk one-on-one to other people. You know, like one person reads it, they talk to several others. And it clearly is impacting the people that do read the book. They're moved to action. That's one thing that is very pleasing to me, is that they're actually moved to get off the couch and, you know, put down the TV remote and, you know, go do something useful with themselves, like either tell other people or start attending their town meetings and stuff where all of this sustainable development Agenda 21 stuff is being implemented, and, you know, get down to the root of it.
Yeah, and as I said to you before the interview, actually, you seem to be perfectly placed to have understood this, really, because of your experience with Anthony Sutton back in the 1970s, I believe it was, and as a consequence of that, you've come to a position where you have this interpretive framework to make sense of so many of the things that are going on in the world today. And you said to me before the interview that you believe that God has led you in that direction.
I really do. You go through life making decisions, some of which you really can make your own decisions about going left or right, but by and large, your life just happens. You know, things go along, and you do things now today that you might never have thought you were going to do 30 years ago. Yeah. So I look back at all the instances in my life, and I say, wow, it just the way it's put together, if any one of those things was taken out of my life, I would not be at all. I would not be where I am today. I would not have had the capacity to understand technocracy, much less research it. And I would not have had the knowledge of the Trilateral Commission to relate that to this big picture as well. So, and, you know, besides that, I have to say that my time with Anthony Sutton gave me skills. He taught me skills that you can't learn in university. He was a very unusual researcher and very meticulous, very methodical. And he had a mind that didn't work like everybody else's mind, I have to say. But what I learned from him, the skills I learned from him, were absolutely essential for the rest of my life, and for especially for studying all this technocracy stuff.
The last time we spoke, you've already mentioned the Trilateral Commission. That's what we concentrated on really last time. And we brought the philosophy of technocracy into that conversation. But in this book, you very much concentrate on the philosophy and the history of technocracy itself, although you bring the Trilateral Commission very much into that story. And you examine how that philosophy is being used. You call it a Trojan horse to bring about global transformation. So could you give us a brief sketch of what technocracy is essentially about and what kind of transformation you're actually talking about?
Well, yes, I can. Back in the 1930s in America, there was an organization actually called Technocracy Incorporated. It was preceded by a movement, still called Technocracy, but a movement that was for a short period of time embedded at Columbia University. The two founders of the movement at that time were Howard Scott and a gentleman by the name of M. King Hubbard. And they were both the co-founders as well of Technocracy Incorporated in 1934. And at that time, the world was in deep depression, especially in America. There's soup lines and food lines, and unemployment was just unbelievable. And there was very little hope. People thought that capitalism had died, and you know, what's going to come of the world? We're just going to fall apart. And it looked that way. And so the scientists and engineers, some scientists and engineers of that day, especially the ones at Columbia University, decided that the only way to save society was to create a new economic model that would replace capitalism. And that's what technocracy is all about. It's an economic system. It defines just a completely new paradigm for the control of economic affairs in society. And they proposed that it would be based on energy rather than on money and supply and demand and capitalism, things we know to free enterprise, things we know and understand today. It would be based on energy. The idea would be that that everybody in society would be issued a certain amount of energy credits or energy currency for a period of time, and that they would buy goods and services at prices that were set according to the energy that it took to make those goods and services. And there was no provision for property rights because why would you need to own anything if everything basically was provided for you? And it basically was, would end up kind of being a completely managed and controlled society by these scientists and engineers. They hated politicians. They saw no need for politicians whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, on the face of it, one might be forgiven for thinking, this sounds a little bit like communism, or it sounds a bit like National Socialism, fascism, or something like that. But you say, there's a quote from you somewhere saying that it's neither of those.
Well, it isn't. And the reason is because it's an economic system, not a political system. Fascism obviously has economic aspects to it, but it's still a political system, a political model. All of those isms are still based on a price-based economy. Even though they're managed economies in different ways, fascism, you have corporate management, and socialism and communism, you have government management of that economic system, you see. It's a top-down management. But technocracy is not capitalism at all. It's completely otherworldly to capitalism. It doesn't share any of those characteristics whatsoever. And it requires a type of management of society that controls goods and services being consumed, being made, being consumed, things being taken out of the earth to make those things and so on. Aldous Huxley, one of yours, I believe.
Indeed.
Aldous Huxley wrote Brave New World in 1932. And Columbia University was just receiving technocracy in 1932. And so you have to ask the question, where did Huxley get his inspiration for Brave New World, for that book? He wrote about scientific dictatorship. and how the system would control everybody, down to even how embryos are controlled and, you know, how people are given their marching orders and how they're going to work and stuff like that, what they'll be allowed to do in their life, maybe who they'd be able to marry, and so on. He was looking at technocracy. That was the only thing going on at the time that had any resemblance to what he was writing about. And he's looking square into the face of technocracy. But fortunately for us, in a way, technocracy had no institutional support in those early days. There was no Rockefeller money. There was no Carnegie money, no foundation money, nothing like that. There's no big person took interest in them. And Columbia University themselves, when they found out that Howard Scott wasn't even an engineer and didn't even have a degree, well, they punted him and the whole movement right out of Columbia. It was a huge disgrace to Columbia at the time. So technocracy went out of favor with Columbia very quickly, but that only encouraged the two co-founders, Scott and Hubbard, to go out on their own and create an actual organization and incorporated it. And then they began to solicit membership around the country, and it was wildly successful, Julian. It was amazing. There was over 500,000 card-carrying members of technocracy during those early days, 1934, 1935.
And you say in the book that Howard Scott was considered to be something of a messiah figure.
Well, people looked at him that way. You know, sometimes we use that word loosely, but people looked at him as the savior of the world, and not in the sense of a spiritual savior to compete with Christ necessarily, but man, this guy has the idea is going to put the world back on track again. And he did nothing to squash that idea either. Even people said it. I'd like the sound of that. But Scott was really just a blowhard. He was not an engineer. He knew all the language and knew some of the terms, but he basically was a promoter. His partner, however, was altogether different. M. King Hubbard was a young geophysicist at the time, well-educated, a very sharp guy. This is also the same M. King Hubbard, by the way, that 20 years later, in 1954, invented the so-called peak oil theory. And he became ultimately one of the fathers of the whole eco movement globally, predicting, of course, that oil was going to run out, the resource reserves and so on are going to be in decline, and we're all going to run out of energy, and therefore we better do something about it. And this, you know, the United Nations and all the way down to the smallest group count M. King Hubbard as one of the fathers of the faith, so to speak, you know.
And that was one of the features of technocracy itself, was it not? The limitation of resources.
That's exactly right. It was a resource-based economy. And they're very concerned about the efficiency of extracting things from the earth and balancing that against the population. I should say limiting the extraction of things from the earth and balancing it with the population. And scientists and engineers have a different perspective. And by the way, I'm not bashing scientists and engineers in general. When I use that term, there's really only a relatively small percentage of scientists and engineers that are really involved with technocracy even today. The rest of them, I know many scientists and engineers personally that are great people. They don't go into this wild philosophical thing. They don't want to control the world. They don't want to control society and so on.
Yes, I mean, one of the things that you say in the book to sort of qualify this is you make it clear that the people who are wrapped up in this way of thinking really had swallowed the ideas of scientism and positivism and humanism that came from the Enlightenment, really, with figures. I mean, Dr. Martin Erdmann spoke about Auguste Comte and Henri Saint-Simon and how their ideas had been picked up. And so this is not just about being a scientist or an engineer. It's embracing a certain philosophy. Do you want to explain what scientism and positivism are so that we're on track with this?
Well, I can. You know, the father of technocracy was Henri de Saint-Simon. He was a French philosopher that lived in the late 1700s and the early 1800s. And he was a guy that today is credited as really being the philosophical touchstone for everything relating to technocracy today. And one of the things he wrote was really stunning. Quote, "A scientist, my dear friends, is a man who foresees. It is because science provides the means to predict that it is useful. And scientists are superior to all other men." Close quote.
Okay.
Now, there's a couple of problems with this statement, obviously. The scientists are not superior to all other men. They are just men. But this is an easy ego trip, you see. When somebody like an ancient philosopher says, hey, oh, you're a scientist now? Wow, you're superior to everyone else. This is an attitude that's pretty easy for mankind to accept if you happen to be a scientist, you know, say, wow, that's, I didn't know that, but I like the sound of that.
Sure.
And then the other thing that's really dangerous about this is that St. Simon postulated that a scientist is able to predict the future. And he says it pointedly. He says, the man who foresees is because science provides the means to predict the future that is useful. Well, it's not given to man to know the future. The Bible says that very clearly. And I've never seen anybody yet, including Nostradamus or anybody else, ever been able to predict the future with any kind of certainty whatsoever. It's just wild guesses, and some of them end up being right. Men do not have the ability to predict the future. And yet, this is one of the basic assumptions that started out with scientism way back when, that, hey, you know, these people that are into science, they somehow have a crystal ball here where they can see what's coming down the road. So you see all of this stuff today about, for instance, climate change, for instance, and Mr. Al Gore, who's a member of the Trilateral Commission, by the way, and we need to relate them properly where we can. Al Gore is the poster child for climate change, global warming issues, and basically he said that all the ice in the world is going to melt and the seas are going to rise and we're all going to die. You know, we haven't yet, but he keeps crowing that mantra. Well, you see, Al Gore believes that he can predict the future because of science, you see. He's using science to predict what's going to happen in the future. And I'm sorry, but he is not going to predict the future in the way he thinks it's going to turn out. Whatever he's saying, it won't happen that way. I can just virtually guarantee him. But Al Gore has a religious belief that he is superior to all other men and that he has the ability to predict the future. See, very little has changed since St. Simon back in, when he died in 1825.
It's very interesting that you should call that a religious belief, this idea that you can predict the future, you can know everything through science, because as Martin Eldon was saying, actually Saint-Simon and Auguste Comte in particular yep. had some kind of attitude towards religion, that if you could somehow put the scientific worldview together with religion, then that would be a useful and profitable thing to do in order to harness that aspect of human psychology, presumably. And, you know, the idea that somebody like Al Gore has a religion of this makes quite a lot of sense within that tradition.
It very much is a religion. It has a priesthood. It has an oracle and a priesthood. The oracle, of course, is science. The priesthood are the scientists and engineers who basically alone are able to determine what the oracle speaks. I use the example of the mythical volcano. You know, the priest runs up to the top of the volcano and listens carefully to see what the volcano is saying to the people down below. And he comes down from the mountain and he tells the people, well, the volcano says that you need to sacrifice two virgins by the 15th of the next month, or else the volcano is going to spew fire and ash all over you and kill you all. And the poor people down below have no knowledge, really, what the volcano said. Of course, the volcano said nothing, right? But it's basically just the priest that said, hey, this is what you need to do. The priest is controlling the people, and the people just blithely go along with it and follow the instructions they're given by this priest, who alone has the supposed ability to understand what the oracle has said. And this is basically what this priesthood of scientism, in a sense, is doing today. They and they alone are able to interpret the scientific reports and determine what science really says to mankind. And it's nonsense, absolutely nonsense. It's the biggest scam that's ever been pulled on the face of the planet, ever.
Well, there's another aspect to this. Looking at this from a slightly religious point of view, you mentioned in the book about holism and the importance of that to technocratic thinking, which is not what you'd expect, considering you've just talked about science and engineering and all that kind of thing. You mentioned a guy called Jan Christian Smuts and his book Holism and Evolution. Do you want to say how that fits into the picture of technocracy?
Well, Smuts was a very brilliant man, I do believe. He was involved in the founding of the League of Nations. He was prominent in South Africa. He was prominent in Great Britain. The guy was a statesman, supposedly, but he came up with this idea of holism and evolution. And of course, back in those days, in the early 1900s, everybody was searching for some new philosophy. Communism was on the scene. Marxism was on the scene. You know, fascism was growing. And everybody was always talking about the new thing. And so Smuts was part of that whole thing. The idea of holism is what he called the theory of the whole, that a thing, anything, its sum is of greater importance than its component parts. So a little thing like you and I as individuals, well, we're a member of a family, let's say. We got a family. So our family is greater than us, then your family is part of a community in your neighborhood. So then you have the neighborhood is greater than your family. And then you maybe have the city that you live in. The city is greater than the community, and so on up the line until you get to the whole universe. And he believed that the whole of society and Earth as well was basically one big living organism, and that everything down the line from the top should be subservient to the higher thing. And this is where you get the whole concept of the greater good. You know, that we should do things, quote unquote, for the greater good. Well, that's never really defined, but it really has its roots in this philosophy of holism. It's kind of esoteric in a way to understand, because you say, well, okay, I'm still a person. I still live where I live. I am what I am. But philosophically, when people that want to control society start to use this concept of holism, your individual sovereignty must be submitted to the greater good, to all of the other little holons that are above you. And you need to be a good little team player. And if you're not, you're going to get busted somehow. You know, you're going to get put in the line.
It does strike me as being somehow related to the philosophy of the One, which Carl Tikrib was talking about, where everything gets its value from being understood as part of just one big reality. Yeah. So things on the individual level, well, they're almost illusory, really. You get to understand the value of the parts by relating it to the ultimate reality, which is the oneness of all things, and so, which is why I thought of this in religious terms. It does seem to be very close to that way of thinking.
It does, and it is, and we can see it expressed in all kinds of different ways in modern society. The only reason I put it in the book is it interested me. Say, well, somebody, this is exactly what is happening today, and here's where it came from. There's nothing new under the sun. You know, these people that come up with these ideas today, they say, oh, this is all brand new stuff. You know, we just figured this out. No, you didn't. I'm sorry. You know, I hate to burst your little bubble, but you didn't think anything up. You're basically just rewarming what somebody has said before you 1,000 times.
Sure. So we have these two prongs of the fork, as it were, the scientific trajectory and also this mystical oneness trajectory. And they've got to somehow work their way into the consciousness of ordinary people. And one strategy that you point to is the Fabian socialist strategy. Do you want to say something about that?
You know, the one thing that Fabian socialism had going for itself was that it took the slow and run route of changing society, rather than being revolutionary. Like, for instance, the Bolshevik Revolution was a bloody revolution, and it resulted in the instant imposition of communism on a whole nation. Fabian socialism took the slow route. He said, well, we'll get there, like the tortoise and the hare, the race, you know. We'll get there, but we're going to get there in a slow way. We're going to gradually change things, change society, until it bends our way. And this is exactly what we've seen being used, the principle has been used by the Trilateral Commission starting in 1973. They knew back then that they had to take an end run around everything, whatever national sovereignty, you know, personal sovereignty and so on, and societies, that they couldn't just go in and do it and conquer people. It would be too costly and too bloody, but they could do it if they took the time with it and planned it out in advance, took the slow approach to it. They could do basically anything that they wanted to do, and they have. They've used it tremendously effectively today.
Yeah, I want to examine with you some of these end runs, because there are a number of ways in which they've not just attempted to achieve that, but have to some extent succeeded in achieving that.
Yeah.
But of course, we've missed out the big story about the Trilateral Commission. We covered that in the previous interview, so I do encourage people to go back and listen to that one to get the fuller picture of this. But could I move to the end run of the international trade deal? Because this is very important in your book. You say that this is the Trilateral Commission's vision of this new economic world order. So the whole globe is in view here. And originally, the vision of the technocracy movement was limited really to the American continent. You say they wanted to unify the US, Mexico, Central America, parts of South America. They had no idea of how they were going to achieve that, but that was the goal at the time. But since those days, of course, we've seen the creation of the UN, the European Union, the attempts at a North American Union, and we have these international trade deals. A key quote in your book is from the trilateralist Richard N. Gardner in his famous article, The Hard Road to World Order, where he specifically talks about the need for an end run around national sovereignty. The international trade deals is one way in which this has been achieved. So could you explain how those deals have served to affect that end run?
David Rockefeller himself, in 1998, attributed the success of the European Union back then to early members of the Trilateral Commission working to bring it about. If you were to go back and study the history, I believe, of the EU, you'll find the fingerprints of the Trilateral Commission all over it. That is, the European members of the Trilateral Commission. They become very adept at bringing areas together. And I would say that in Europe, you have a perfect example of how an end run around national sovereignty took place. Nobody really saw it coming. It started out as an economic union. It sounded good at the time. Yeah, well, there's benefits to it. Yeah, let's just go ahead and do that. And what it's ended up to be now is altogether different than what the people saw in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, when I grew up, it was the EEC. It was the European Economic Community.
That's right. And the emphasis on economics there ties into the new international economic order. This is what it was all about. Regionalism is a very core concept in global order, in the globalization process. And so you have the region in Europe where individual European nations have been stripped of their sovereignty. And you have regionalism going on in North America with the proposed North American Union to include Canada, Mexico, and parts of South America as well into one big union. You have Eurasian Union kind of forming up now, as the signs of it are forming. All of these things are part of the march to globalization, to the globalization process, to bring about this this new international economic order. How they've done it is through the mechanism of the executive branch of the United States government. Our executive branch has been instrumental in driving or directing the global economy for decades and decades, going, I mean, well back into, you know, the early 1900s, we've been instrumental in driving the world stage. The trilaterals knew that if they could get their hands on the machinery of the executive branch, they could control the course of economic history in the world. And so when Jimmy Carter and Walter Mondale took office in 1976, both of whom were members of the Trilateral Commission, they swept in a third of the U.S. membership to top government positions in Carter's cabinet, including Brzezinski, the National Security Advisor. All but one cabinet member was a member of the Trilateral Commission. All of them. They stacked the deck. And you say, well, that's just a coincidence. Or maybe that's just where you find good people. You know, they just happen to have the best people. Well, that's not the case at all. Fast forward in history now and look backwards and see what they've done. The U.S. trade representative is the person who has negotiated all these trade treaties over the years, like NAFTA, for instance, and that's the North American Free Trade Agreement, and CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, and others. Since 1977, when the USTR position was created under Jimmy Carter, there have been 12 appointees by the U.S. president to this position. It's now a cabinet-level position, U.S. trade representative. Out of 12 people, over that period of time, 9 of them have been members of the Trilateral Commission.
Yeah.
See, this is the end run. This is how they did it. Nobody ever cares what the USTR does in public. They never have any press. Nobody has a clue even who they are. But these are the guys who are negotiating this stuff. Carla Hills, who was USTR from 1989 to 93, was the undisputed architect of NAFTA. She was credited back then. Well, she's working for George W. Bush, who was also a member of the commission, by the way. Everybody credits Carla Hills as being the primary architect of NAFTA. It's a trilateral document. Today, Michael Froman is a USTR, and he's negotiating the Trans-Pacific Partnership and also the Transatlantic Partnership. He's a member of the Trilateral Commission. Okay. Okay, I ask the question, well, do I trust them to represent my interest as a citizen of America, or are they representing the corporate interest or the collective interest of members of the Trilateral Commission? And it's just, you know, you can't even ask, that's a stupid question, it's a rhetorical question.
And you also say that the fast track authority that was given to the president, that also was a trilateralist project in itself.
It was. I believe it was. The fast track authority was first granted as an act in 1974. And that was a time of turmoil here because Richard Nixon had just resigned and his vice president, Gerald Ford, had assumed the presidency. He wasn't elected. He bumped up. And when that happens, the Constitution provides for him, the new president, to appoint or select a vice president for himself. It doesn't matter who. It has to be confirmed by the Senate, but it doesn't matter who it is. And that person is not elected. Well, who he appointed to be his vice president was none other than Nelson Rockefeller, the brother of David Rockefeller.
It's amazing how many times that name appears, isn't it?
I know. It just keeps popping up. And here's the thing about Rockefeller as vice president. One of the key positions that the vice president holds that gives significance to his job is that he is president of the Senate. In other words, he provides over the Senate and has tremendous influence over what the Senate does. And so when the Trade Act of 1974 was ushered through, it had fingerprints of those early trilateral people all over it. And basically what it did is it gave the president the authority to negotiate trade treaties and present them to the Senate for ratification, disallowing any amendment. In other words, it can't be changed. The whole trade treaty has to have an up or down vote, yes or no. No bills can be attached to it in any way, no amendments, no modifications whatsoever. And the time for debate was limited to, I think, to like 3 days or something. It was just a ridiculously small amount of time, not even enough time for people really to read the whole treaty. Then, in addition to that, when it went in effect, it only required a 51% vote to pass the Senate. And normally, the Constitution grants the Senate powers to negotiate all foreign treaties, 100%, and requires a two-thirds vote to pass. Now, two-thirds of anybody requires nonpartisan sponsorship. You know, some people have to cross over the line from, you know, Democrat, Republican, whatever, and vote for this thing. So it's very difficult to get anything through our Congress with a 66% vote. But at 50%, you can get anything through. It's the bottom line. And so Fast Track was implemented back in 1974, even though it had a sunset provision where it automatically expired. It's been renewed periodically over time to pass these important treaties like NAFTA. They were able to get Fast Track reinstated to pass NAFTA on a 51% vote. And right now that the Trans-Pacific Partnership is being presented, the president says it's ready now. And he's pushing for this fast-track legislation again. If Congress approves it, he'll be able to slam dunk this thing through the Senate with a 51% vote. Everybody knows the votes are already there. So the real issue right now is whether he's going to get fast-track authority. But this has been one of the main velvet sledgehammers that the Trilateral Commission has used against America. And these trade treaties don't just change us. They change you as well. Yeah. They change the whole world.
Yeah, I think there's something fascinating that you point out on page 63 of the book. You quote Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution. Let me just read this. All treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. Anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary, notwithstanding. So treaties trump the laws of the state, they trump the Constitution, and if the president is given this fast-track authority, then presumably he is effectively in control of the whole lot and can just do an end run around the Constitution and the laws of any state if he so chooses.
That's exactly right, and that's exactly what's going to happen.
Okay, so another end run is also the green economy, which you bring out in the book as well. Of course, this sounds on the surface like a really good thing. We've looked at this on the program quite a bit, actually, the notion of sustainable development. And we've obviously noted that it can contain some very good ideas, you know, about looking after the environment, not being wasteful, not being irresponsible, that kind of thing. But it's a phrase that is so vague that it can mean pretty much anything you want it to. Well, anybody in power wants it to mean, which makes it quite scary in some ways. And one of the core things that it usually means is communitarian thinking, in which the, going back to this holism idea, really, that the good of the whole is said to trump the rights of individuals because we've got to look after, in inverted commas, the planet. And what I've found interesting is that this phrase, sustainable development, is never used in the early days of technocracy, you say, but the idea of it is very central to the thinking of the technocratic movement.
It is. we need to go back and look at a little bit of history on where the word sustainable development came from in the first place, where it was really popularized. The 1992 Rio conference held in Rio de Janeiro was the conference that produced the book Agenda 21. There was other books that came out of it as well, but that was the primary one, Agenda 21. That was the agenda for the 21st century. And this has been the touchstone book for everything that the United Nations has done since in implementing this policy around the world of sustainable development. The United Nations itself gives credit to the Rio conference intellectually to a committee that had been started by the UN earlier in 1987 called the Brundtland Commission. And the Brundtland Commission was headed by the ex-prime minister of Norway, Gro Harlem Brundtland. She was also the minister of ecological stuff in Norway before she became prime minister. But she was appointed by the United Nations to head up this organization to produce the policies that would go down the road. I don't know if they really had in mind the 1992 conference at the time, but the Brundtland Commission produced a book called Our Common Future. It's still in print today. People can go to Amazon and buy it, Our Common Future. This was the book that provided the intellectual fodder for the Rio conference and for all the policies that wound up in the book Agenda 21. That's where sustainable development started.
And she was a member of the Trilateral Commission again, is that right?
She was a member of the Trilateral Commission. That's exactly right.
It's absolutely incredible. I mean, one of the things you do in the book, of course, is to type in bold everybody who's involved with the Trilateral Commission. And it's on every page. They keep on popping up. It's quite incredible.
Well, they deserve the attention, don't they? In my opinion, they deserve the attention. So you have to ask, was sustainable development just something that happened because society was ready for it? Or did it happen because it was a policy that was purposely pushed by members of the Trilateral Commission? And I will vote for the latter in every case. This is exactly where it came from, and they've had their fingerprints all over it ever since.
So this is where
Brundtland got a hold of it.
So this is where all this, you say, Agenda 21, all its councils of government comes out of that. The Earth Charter, the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, amongst other things, it all sort of comes from this, as you say, this intellectual foundation.
That's right. That's exactly where it came from. And more than just intellectual, I guess, it was, you know, they have been the drivers of this since then as well. And their fingerprints, like for instance, Bill Clinton was totally instrumental in impressing sustainable development on America. Clinton did a number of things in the 1990s, after the 1992 convention, to impress sustainable development in every corner of our nation. And it is today. You know, people still would scratch their head over this and wonder, well, how does this end up? Where is this going? You know, it's vague. All the facts aren't on the table. Well, let me tell you what the executive secretary of the UN framework on the Convention of Climate Change said recently. Her name is Cristiana Figueres. She's a Costa Rican diplomat. But she's the number one climate change person at the United Nations. And remember, Agenda 21, this is where all this stuff started. And Cristiana Figueres now is the head person. She's not a member of the commission, but she's the head person on climate change at the United Nations. And this is what she said on February 3rd of this year in a press conference in Europe. And some sharp person, journalist, picked it up and reported it for us. But this is a direct quote. She said, quote, "This is the first time in the history of mankind that we are setting ourselves the task of intentionally, within a defined period of time, to change the economic development model that has been reigning for at least 150 years since the Industrial Revolution," close quote. Now, you see, she's pulled all the blinders off here, given us a glimpse at the end game. The end game is to destroy capitalism and to implement what the United Nations calls a green economy. And that's well defined by the United Nations, what that means. She doesn't talk about the green economy here. She only talks about getting rid of the economic development model that's been reigning for the last 150 years since the Industrial Revolution. Now, you can't mistake that for any other economic model other than capitalism, because that's all we've had.
But when people hear that term, green, then they just think it's only to do with looking after the environment. And I think a lot of people don't actually think further than that and don't analyze the other words that are coming out. But it's more than that, isn't it?
Well, it really is. The United Nations Environmental Program, UNEP, on their website, defines a little short snippet that defines a green economy. This is a direct quote. A green economy implies the decoupling of resource use and environmental impacts from economic growth. These investments, both public and private, provide the mechanism for the reconfiguration of businesses, infrastructure, and institutions, and for the adoption of sustainable consumption and production processes. Close quote. Now, that's their definition of a green economy. It's full of oxymorons, for one thing. How do you decouple resource use from economic growth? You can't. If you have a business and you want your business to grow, you have to have resource use. You have to use resources. You have inputs that you have to make your whatever it is you're making, materials or energy or something going into it to make it. But they say we're going to decouple resource use and environmental impacts from economic growth. And then the investments that are being made to do this, they say, provide the mechanism for the reconfiguration of businesses. And I say, who cares how you reconfigure a business? If it's your business, do what you want. But then it goes right on to say to reconfigure infrastructure and institutions. Now, at this, I say, hold up. Because what are they talking about reconfiguring infrastructure and institutions? So you see, this is governments. This refers to the national structure of our nations and how the governance process works and how government works. So the green economy doesn't just stop with some kind of, you know, fairy tale, kumbaya, let's all do good to Mother Earth sort of thing. No, the green economy drills down into it and says, we're going to restructure the entire planet. We're going to reconfigure the infrastructure. We're going to reconfigure the institutions that you people rely on for your social existence. We're going to reconfigure those institutions. And then in other places, they go on to tell you how they're going to reconfigure our institutions. And if you get that far down into it, the hair will be standing up on the back of your neck. It really will.
Well, if all this is decoupling from economic growth, then it seems to me that what's needed is to have a redefinition of what economic growth actually means. And presumably that doesn't mean anything like what we've understood it to mean in the past.
Honestly, I don't know what they mean by economic growth. I think they're just using that term just to appease everybody else that it has something to do with economic growth. In America, I can give you a good example of the lunacy of this policy. There are currently 25,000 dams, water dams in America that are slated to be destroyed. Now, one of our primary sources of energy, especially in the Northwest, is from hydroelectric power. And people have figured out very efficiently how to get free energy from the rivers, you know, by using turbines and so on. As the water runs downhill, it can create electricity. And this is a wonderful thing. If you live in the Northwest anyway, it's a wonderful thing. And, of course, dams provide water conservation for us as well. And, you know, when droughts happen, if you have a big lake somewhere, you draw water for a long time and you get through the drought and snows come and they fill the thing back up again. And so dams have been a very good sign of progress over the years. They've done had a lot of benefit for mankind. A lot of economic development has been done around dams in America, like recreational facilities and marinas and boating and, you know, parks and all that kind of stuff. And yet today there's 25,000 dams that are slated for destruction. They want to blow them up and return the rivers to their quote unquote natural state. No particular reason given on why you'd want to do that, because the rivers still are just perfectly fine on the other side of the dam as the water comes out. There's just great rivers going down. So you look back in history a little bit and say, who came up with the idea to blow up all the dams in a stupid country in the first place? Traces back to the Clinton administration during the 90s, to the policies of the man who was the head of the Department of Interior at the time. He was the guy that came up with the policies to blow up the dams. Singularly responsible for this policy today, that's well documented, was a man by the name of Bruce Babbitt, a former governor of Arizona, where I live, by the way. Came from a ranching family in northern Arizona. Bruce Babbitt was a member of the Trilateral Commission. Lo and behold.
And what's his rationale for doing this?
There is no rationale. Honestly, there is no rationale whatsoever that makes any sense from a practical point of view, other than somebody that's thinking in terms of a green economy. Because you see, in a green economy, this implies a decoupling of resource use and environmental impacts from economic growth. They have nothing to do with each other.
So at the heart of this, it seems to be a kind of utopian return to nature kind of mentality.
That's exactly right.
Where human beings have interfered, in inverted commas, with the world as it should be in its sort of pristine state, then get rid of that and return to how it should be.
That's right. With no regard to any economic growth that's resulted from these dams being in place in the first place. It is a mental disconnect, I grant. It is. But this is the way these people think. And this is why it's so dangerous. This, you know, when you look back at books like Brave New World in 1984, which also was written with technocracy in mind, some of it you take with a grain of salt, but some of it you just have to take to heart and say, you know what? These thoughtful men thought about this, wrote about it. They spun tales and made stories up and stuff around it. But we should be looking at this stuff today and saying, wait a minute, this utopian system, which has never been tried in the history of the world, absolutely no evidence or research that says it's going to work. And yet they're driving it full speed on us, this green economy business. And this is an economic issue, not just a political issue. It really is driven by the economic side of things. And that's what technocracy is all about. Technocracy is about economics. Democracy, a republic, you know, a parliamentary system of government, those things are about government, not economy. Those things have to do with government directly. Technocracy has to do with economy without having really the need to have government in place to do anything, because they're going to govern everything. They're going to regulate everything.
So is this partly why we see the decline in the power of government, because everything of any real value is taking place on this economic level?
That's exactly right. Our Congress has been absolutely neutered. They have no influence over what the executive branch does today. It's just, it's pathetic. But then, I mean, look what happened in the European Union to all the nations of the EU. They find that they have no say anymore either. They've been completely muted and neutered. You know, they get maybe 1 or 2 hours of discussion or time to say anything at the main EU meetings. And it's like, well, somebody else is making the decisions for them. They're appointed. They're not elected. And you just have to like it or else you'll pay fines. We got you by the throat.
And as you said in the previous interview, we got to the situation where now we've actually had people who are overtly called technocrats put into positions of power within Europe, and they've been called technocrats.
Oh, my, yes. In 2011, when Italy and Greece were about ready to go up in flames, the EU appointed 2 people to be prime minister over those countries. That's inconceivable to me, that the EU could actually appoint a prime minister and say, here, you take this guy or else. You know, this guy's supposed to be elected, right? Well, they were appointed. And Italy, the guy they're appointed was Mario Monti. And he was prime minister for a period of time before he left again. But Monti was not only a member of the Trilateral Commission, but he was in charge of the European division of the Trilateral Commission. And they called him a technocrat when they sent him there. They used that word in the European press. Mario Monti was a technocrat sent to be prime minister in Italy to solve their economic problems. And they did the same thing in Greece by sending in, I can't remember his first name, Papademos is his last name. He was also a member of the Trilateral Commission. And they called him a technocrat, using that name, technocrat, when they sent him in. Okay, now how come out of all the people in Europe and all the potential people that could run a country as prime minister or whatever, is it conceivable that the only 2 qualified people are members of the Trilateral Commission, when you only have probably less than 100, maybe about 100 people from Europe that are even members of that organization? Is it conceivable that the only people they could find to fill those slots were members of the Trilateral Commission? I don't think so.
No, I mean, this brings me to one of the things that could be said with a very careless reading of your book would be that, well, you know, you're finding all these links with the Trilateral Commission. Of course, you're putting them in bold so that everybody can see these names. Oh, yes, that person was a member. And therefore, you're just seeing links where, well, they're perhaps tenuous links, really. And you have this thesis that you're developing and finding these pinpoints on the board and saying, ah, yes, that's the big picture. But when you read it carefully, these names do seem to be very much embedded in the Trilateral Commission. You're not just picking out vague associations. They're members, aren't they? And they're very crucial individuals in these developments.
Absolutely so. And in the case of Europe, this just shows you who really had the power. in Europe at the time in 2011? Who was really running things? In other words, was it really just the EU in general, or was there some kind of another core part of that organization that was really running things? And the fact that they appointed two Trilateral Commission members to be the prime ministers in those countries tells me that there is an inner core, in fact, that are calling the shots, and somebody else is saying, hey, this is the person we want in, go put him in. Okay, yes, sir. But you bring up a good point, though, that I want to argue that or defend that thought just a little bit about making spurious connections. One of the main techniques I learned from Anthony Sutton, his main research technique, was to look for patterns. He introduced me to the concept of patterns, not just trying to find events or whatever, but look at patterns of things to discover what's really going on. This is not a theory out of the blue either. Police, for instance, when they investigate a crime, look for patterns to determine what's really going on, what really happened. Sutton taught me this. He says you've got to look for the patterns of things, not just at the surface of it, but you've got to look a little deeper and look for patterns that recur over a period of time, because patterns don't just happen, they're created. And so when we did all of our original work on the Trilateral Commission in the 70s, we really got all of our leads and clues from the patterns of things that we determined were true, where we could identify them clearly. And I carry that philosophy into this book as well, because really that's kind of all I know at this point. It just was imprinted on me. The pattern that you see throughout the sustainable development, Agenda 21, green economy, smart growth, all this stuff, this pattern is unmistakable.
I suppose to a large extent that's a way a historian actually has to work. Is it called abductive reasoning? I think it might be. And it seems to be something that's definite for historians, because of course you can't do it deductively. You can't just have some sort of principle and deduce all the facts of history. Neither can you do it inductively and say that you've got so much data that you can therefore prove that this is the case. But you have to, as you say, accumulate data points and see a pattern and then hypothesize based upon that. I mean, this is what I've picked up from things that historians have said to me.
That's exactly right. So anyway, that just to say that, the bold type, for all the people in my book are in bold type, just so people can just get the point here, where they see somebody, they can just look a little more carefully. What's it talking about that person? And why do they show up again?
Could I skip back to the Earth Charter, because I did mention it in connection with those things that were the fallout of the Rio conference back in 1992. And the Earth Charter, of course, brings us back to the role of religion and, of course, the instrumentalist use of religion to achieve these ends. As indeed does the organization called the Elders, actually. And I was astonished when I came across that. I understand that Gro Harlem Brundtland, along with Jimmy Carter, is actually a member of the Elders, which sounds very, very religious. Could you tell us anything about that group before I ask you about the Earth Charter?
Oh, my. I know. I ran across the Elders some years ago. Interesting group of people. They're the appointed elders of the world to solve difficult problems. Right. You think of Hillary Clinton's book, It Takes a Village, and you think, oh, wow, a village. Yeah, villages have elders, don't they? You look down the list of people who are on the Elders. It's right on their website called theelders.org. And you see people like Nelson Mandela. He's, of course, passed now. You saw Kofi Annan, Gro Harlem Brundtland is on here. She's the deputy chair of the Elders right now. Then you see Jimmy Carter. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Jimmy Carter. Yeah, he's a member. And then you see Mary Robinson from Ireland. She's a member of the Trilateral Commission. Then you see Ernesto Zedillo from Mexico. And he was a member of the Trilateral Commission as well. They have like five of these people on here out of 10 or whatever, almost half of them are members of the Trilateral Commission. I don't know what the Elders do, that they're impactful in anything. But I'll tell you what bothers me about it is this condescending attitude that we're the Elders of the world. That really bothers me.
Yeah. And it does have this sort of connotation of spirituality about it, doesn't it? A kind of priesthood feel to it.
Yes, it definitely does.
Yeah. Sorry, I shouldn't really have butted in there with that one, should I? I was talking about the Earth Charter, but it just occurred to me, I've got to ask you about the elders. Yeah. But I mean, the Earth Charter itself, there's overtly religious language in there, isn't there?
Absolutely.
I mean, you have this printed, it was one of the appendices at the end of your book, and you say that it's clearly exploiting human beings' religious sensibilities in various ways for the purposes of technocracy. Could you sort of talk through that? I mean, we've got figures like Stephen Rockefeller, that name coming up again. Isn't he a theologian?
He is. He is tightly related to the Rockefeller family, obviously. I believe he was the director of the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, among other things. He's been instrumental in Rockefeller affairs for a long time. But he's never been part of the bank. He's never been part of, you know, industry. He's a theologian. And in particular, his claim to significance and fame, I guess, is his work on interfaith movement throughout the world, bringing different religions together and stuff into a common framework.
A kind of all is one kind of thing, perhaps.
That's right. Yeah, you know, you can maintain your own tradition, but, there's unity and diversity and that sort of thing. And he's been very effective at doing that over the last, 30 years. He's been moving around in the background. I mean, who's gonna pay attention to a guy like Stephen Rockefeller anyway? The press don't follow him around, it doesn't follow him. But he's been out there working, and his work in the interfaith movement has tied many different segments of society together that you wouldn't think would normally be tied together. One of the evidences of that is if you go to the website of, for instance, the World Council of Churches, or in our country, the National Council of Churches, or if you just go to the main denomination websites, like the Catholic Church, Episcopal Church, and so on, you'll find that they have all turned green. And when I say green, they're all talking about climate change. They're all talking about sustainable development. And, you have to ask the question, how did this happen? Who did this? How did all the churches of the world get impregnated, if you will, with green philosophy from the United Nations? How did this happen? Well, you look at people like Stephen Rockefeller and you understand. But all the religions of the world are sold out. Even the Pope has declared that there's a major encyclical coming by June on climate change policy. And now that's not church law. An encyclical goes out to all the bishops, but it's not hard official doctrine like it would be if he wrote a papal bull. But an encyclical is extremely important in that it goes out to all the bishops around the world, and they're expected to do something about it. The idea is the Pope is driving this from the top down, as well as all the other religions in the world now, too. It's stunning.
What strikes me about this is that really the alarm bell should have rung with regard to the Earth Charter, certainly in Christian circles, because you've got these people like Mikhail Gorbachev saying things like, who was involved with this, of course, saying cosmos is my God, nature is my God, and Maurice Strong saying, and this is a quote, the real goal of the Earth Charter is that it will become, in fact, like the Ten Commandments. And you say in the book that it was carried around in a kind of new Ark of the Covenant at one point. I mean, this really should have been a kind of red rag to a bull, shouldn't it, for the Christians?
It should have been. I know. I don't remember anybody really paying attention when that actually took place. But yes, there's religious overtones found anywhere you find a group of people that are talking about sustainable development, like, orchestrated from the United Nations point of view. You find a little conference, wherever it might be, big or small, you will find that religious component there that are talking about spiritual things. Now, that doesn't mean everybody's following them around, listening to them either. But you'll find that in virtually every meeting that we can see. And you can go look at the websites of some of these organizations and see the meetings they've had. And pretty much in every case, you're going to see a footnote that there was some spiritual implication to it, that somebody was there doing something of a spiritual nature.
And would you agree that from the point of view of the technocrats, that they are actually exploiting religion? That this isn't some sort of, in many cases anyway, not a sort of deeply held view, but they're saying, well, look, religion is one of these pillars that you talk about, three pillars of society that are necessary for a society to function. And they're saying, these are one of the necessary pillars. We have to have a religious component in order for this to work. Well, let's use that and bring about our purposes that way.
That's true. And religion probably is more loosely defined today by these people than it has been in history. But if you go back to the early 70s in particular, you'll find the Trilateral Commission was very heavily involved with the Aspen Institute for Humanistic Studies in America. And they later changed the name just to the Aspen Institute, so it doesn't sound so religious. But the Aspen Institute has spread to the corporate world around the world. They have spread the philosophy of humanism and things like, you know, embedded in the Earth Charter to people, executives, to government people all around the world. They've been incredibly successful. And this is, make no mistake about it, humanism is a religion. It's been declared as a religion by the U.S. Supreme Court. And it has all the trappings of religion, and especially in its early days at the Aspen Institute. And I am certain, looking backwards, that they understood that they need to cover the bases on that. That's part of society you cannot get away from. The religious side has to be there because people want to believe in something. Doesn't matter what they believe in. They want to believe in something. They want to have a cause. They want to have a God that they can go to, yeah. Whether they're Hindu or Buddhist or whatever. And they recognize that other kind of faith, you know, that people have, it allows them to twist reality in front of their eyes so they can do other things to them. And so, yeah, we see it going all the way back from day one with members of the Trilateral Commission being involved, for instance, with the Aspen Institute for Humanistic Studies.
Talking about connecting the dots, as I said, there are so many that are connected. One other one is, of course, this business about the Internet of Things and the smart grid. Because, of course, if this technocratic vision for an energy-based system of global control is going to happen, I mean, in the past it wouldn't have been feasible, but now the infrastructure is possible and it's growing. You indicate in the book that this is being instantiated through the smart grid and through the Internet of Things. Could you tell us how those two things fit together and how they fit into the overall picture?
The reason these things are important is because the scientific dictatorship that's being crafted is to be a system. It's not to be a person. We talk about a person becoming a dictator like, well, maybe it's maybe it's Mario Draghi or maybe it's Barack Obama or whoever, you know, Putin. Those are people. Those are individuals. And individuals in a global context cannot – one individual cannot possibly run the whole world anyway. So the system of things that's growing up, which was originally proposed by technocracy, the system itself is to be using the scientific method, using science, is to be, and technology, is to be the dictator. It's going to be the thing that limits everybody to do certain things, either to not do certain things or to do other things. And this system is closing in around our necks everywhere we look. Now, having said that, let's talk about smart grid. Smart grid is a specification from the early 1930s, or at least in principle, that energy needs to be controlled. Consumption and production of energy needs to be controlled and monitored. And the smart grid that we have today, with these digital meters being put on everything, all this got started in 2009. It all got started with stimulus money. All around the world. At first, I saw the stimulus money in our country being used for it. I was surprised. And then I started looking at other countries, including Great Britain and other countries in Europe and even in China and Mexico. They use stimulus money at the same time for the same purpose to kickstart smart grid. And then I found that there's a global smart grid being created all around the world today that will aggregate data from every nation that's tied into the smart grid to create literally what they call an internet of energy. This is just an incredible concept. Why would anybody want to have an internet of energy? Well, the idea is to be able to control the use and consumption of energy from the top down, to be able to limit the energy that you use in your household. And the new appliances that are being made today, you know, like air conditioners and refrigerators and other things inside your home, are being made with chips, circuits that will talk to the smart meters on the side of the house or business, so that the utility can control those appliances in your house without your intervention. And so if they need to balance the power, you know, the load of power a little bit, they can, dial it back on a whole neighborhood or a whole city, you know, limit the amount of power consumption and so on, and basically control your life. They want you to wash your clothes at 3 o'clock in the morning, while they can turn off your washer for all that other period of time. And, you have to get up at 3 and wash your clothes. This is actually happening in certain parts of the world right now. But smart grid is a master plan to control energy. And people don't relate this to technocracy unless they listen to me just a little bit. Because yeah. I can relate it to technocracy very well. The technocracy study course that was written in 1934 by M. King Hubbard, who we already talked about. The first five requirements to this, I'm just going to give you the first two because they deal with smart grid. We'll get the other three in a minute. Quote, this is a direct quote from their book. Register on a continuous 24-hour-per-day basis the total net conversion of energy. Number two, quote, by means of the registration of energy converted and consumed, make possible a balanced load, close quote. Now, this is all you hear from the utility companies today. Go read the website of somebody like Siemens in Germany. You'll see this concept of balanced load everywhere you look there. They're going to regulate energy to make a balanced load. Well, it used to be that if a community needed more energy, well, a utility was supposed to just go out and build more power plants and supply it, but not today. A balanced load today is going to be balanced on the back of consumers, not on the back of the utility to have to make more investment. But in any case, we see the smart grid being put in as a very specific requirement of technocracy. This was written back in 1934, but it could have been written today.
And how does that relate to the Internet of Things?
Well, the Internet of Things is expressed, for instance, in the interaction of the smart meter on the side of your home and your washing machine or your air conditioner inside your home, talking to each other. They're communicating with each other. One has the ability to control the other. That's part of, you know, paradigm of the Internet of Things. Things talk to each other rather than people, rather than you sitting at your computer and me sitting at my computer and we're typing messages back and forth. We're communicating with each other. When things communicate with each other, there's no humans involved. So in a neighborhood sense, let's say there's a neighborhood computer that watches electrical use in the neighborhood. And if all of a sudden there is something going on in the neighborhood that requires the computer program to intervene, maybe to cut back energy on certain things or maybe to cut back a certain time of day, the computer just automatically intercedes and does it, communicates the instructions blindly to all the other things that are communicating with it, and it's done. It's just done. There's no human intervention. Now, they're talking about connecting essentially everything on the planet with everything else.
Yes. This is rather confusing because people do talk about chips being put, say, in a pair of shoes or being put in a shirt or a coat and, you know, virtually everything so that all of this would be surveilled. But I have communication with a listener who's involved with fitting smart meters, and he says that at the moment that technology is not in place. The meters are not actually able to read everything like that, although he says he doesn't discount that that might come along in the future.
Right. Well, in America, there's actually Congress actually passed a law that requires appliance makers to embed the circuitry into all the appliances that we make. And I believe if you look at some of the other major appliance makers over there in Europe, you'll probably find them doing the same thing at this point. But maybe spotty on a global basis right now. But this is clearly the concept, and it's clearly been enforced here in America since it started in 2009. And you're right about it. Everything communicates with everything else, sometimes interactively, sometimes not. For instance, if there's a chip in your shoe, another chip nearby, if you walk by or something, isn't going to like cause you to stop walking. There's no control involved there. There is a monitoring aspect, perhaps. But when you consider the possibility of different things interacting with each other, all passing data to some master program that's going to be making decisions for your life on what you can and can't do, this is the danger in the Internet of Things. This is a very great danger.
And the fascinating thing is, as you said before, we're not talking about human beings controlling this. We're talking about something being set up as notionally a perfectly rational system.
That's right.
To make decisions by way of artificial intelligence, presumably, on behalf of human beings.
That's right. Exactly. And they can be benevolent or they could be malevolent.
That is a very, very frightening picture, actually. Yeah, indeed.
But this is the system. This is the system that's being created today to control everything in the world, including people. And as the system gains cohesiveness, as it starts to tie together, all of the elements are in place now. As they start to hook these various elements up together, that's when we are really going to feel the heat of the system asserting its dictatorship over our practical and real lives. It's coming. It's already here to a great extent, but you can extrapolate some stories that could be very feasible in the very near future. For instance, let's say if a smart grid were in place and the authorities know how much energy you're using in your home, And they decide that you are an overconsumer because you're consistently 20% higher than all the rest of your neighbors. Okay, they know that, right? And so you think, I'd like to visit my cousin in New York City. I'm going to get online here and buy me a plane ticket. And I'm going to fly to New York City and spend a couple of weeks over there visiting my cousin. So you get online and you're working on buying your ticket, and you get one selected, and you push the buy button, and a little message comes up on the screen and says you've exceeded your carbon allocation for the quarter, and you're not allowed to fly.
Yeah. So looking back to those early days, so the doctrine of holism is actually, in a way, programmed into the system.
That's right.
Not allowing you to do what you quite reasonably want to do.
That's exactly right. So the program might say, do better to cut down on your consumption at home, and maybe next month try again.
Lovely. Yeah, but you know, a lot of people would say there's just no way in which human beings are going to accept this. And yet one of the things, perhaps the last thing I want to ask you about really, is you point out that there is actually a way through this for the technocrat by actually changing the nature of human beings. And you bring up the whole question of transhumanism in this. You know, is it possible that in some way we will be changed, perhaps persuaded to undergo various changes to become post-human in various ways, and that will actually allow us to accept this state of affairs?
I think this is a big carrot. I think the promise of escaping the laws of sin and death is a huge, huge draw for many people, especially for non-Christians, I might add, that have no biblical basis or biblical thinking. death is a very final thing for them. And, you know, if science could deliver on what used to be a metaphysical quest for immortality, now that science has come along and is promising some things to extend life and possibly to conquer death altogether, this is a huge, huge carrot for people to buy into it. You know, in my personal opinion, I think this is the grandest deception that the world has ever seen, because I do not believe there will be one person ever that will escape the laws of death, because that's exactly what the Bible says. It's appointed for man once to die, and then comes judgment. They're running after this like there's no tomorrow, for sure. And they're sure they can do it. If they just get a little bit more science down, they're sure they can do it. But on the other hand, they haven't produced one shred of success since this whole movement really started in earnest some 30 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at it at its most stark, the idea of perhaps uploading yourself into the mainframe, and that does seem very, very extreme, but one could conceive of it, and I think one must conceive of it, on a very small, incremental level, that, you know, there might be ways in which our brains might be enhanced, and therefore that would coax us into a sense of security with regard to, you know, a little bit of loss of freedom, and then a little bit more enhancement, and then we'll accept a little bit more loss of freedom, and that way you could step this up towards total loss of freedom.
Yes, it could. There's many risks and many dangers in the transhuman movement. And not incidentally, one of the leading transhuman figures is a man by the name of Ray Kurzweil, who is a scientist, engineer from the Silicon Valley in California originally. He's a brilliant, brilliant man, truly. But he believes that the technology is going to supersede man's ability to control it by somewhere around 2045. He calls it the singularity, where machines and computers and artificial intelligence will advance at a rate faster than man's ability to even think about or conceive about it, and that will also coincide with the whole concept of immortality and the transhuman dream to escape the body, be uploaded into the brain of a machine or something like that. Maybe travel in space, maybe have yourself an android body or whatever. But Ray Kurzweil is working for Google these days. He didn't need a job, but Google offered him a job as senior scientist there, and he took it, not because of money, but he took it because of the resources that Google has to allow him to achieve his goals. And he's had a documentary, got a book. People can read about Ray Kurzweil and find out what he believes. He's really intent on conquering death. And it just so happens that this is a weak link, by the way, but it just so happens that the chairman of Google, which admittedly is one of the most powerful companies in the world today, Eric Schmidt, was just inducted into the Trilateral Commission 2 years ago. So, yeah, these people, same people that are crafting the world, have a very keen eye on this whole business of transhumanism, And philosophically speaking, they both share the same belief in scientism. So they're like Siamese twins. You know, one focuses on society itself and the other focuses on individuals.
And when you take Google there, you can see the incremental process going, can't you? You know, with these sort of super glasses will give you access to the internet at all times. And it's only just one step away then from having a chip in your brain to give your consciousness access to the internet at all times. And all those, it seems, in a way, they are actually, well, they're tantamount to loss of freedom at the same time as gaining intellectual enhancement. You know, your loss of liberty in just taking those on board your very person.
Yes, I know. And it was Google, by the way. They were the first to suggest a brain implant that would tie into Google search engines and stuff. Yeah. They're working on it. I think they're going to come up with sawdust in the end of it, but they're throwing all the resources they can muster at it right now. They really are. And so is the government. Governments of the world are backing this 100%.
As you say, it's a carrot, isn't it? Whether it actually happens is another matter, but it's persuading people to go along with all this.
It is. And this has always been a case of, you know, with deceptions throughout history. You know, people follow deceptions. The deceivers may or may not know that they're actually deceiving, but the effect's the same. It doesn't matter. People follow them. What they're looking for is people to follow them. And they've got a lot of people following right now in society. And it's a philosophy that, I mean, you know, if somebody didn't have any other hope, why on earth wouldn't they be interested in transhumanism? You know, it's like,
well, exactly. If you haven't got another hope, exactly. And really, that's where I wanted to leave things. I didn't want to leave the interview with a sense of doom and gloom and absolute hopelessness, because that's not true. Looking at it from a biblical perspective anyway, there is, of course, fantastic hope through Christ. And I know that you won't have the opportunity to say things like this on every interview that you do, because, of course, I know that you speak very, very widely. But on this podcast, you do have absolute freedom to say that. So do you want to say something about the real hope that stretches before us?
Well, yeah, certainly I do. I think there needs to be within the Christian community a resurgence of excitement about Bible prophecy. Mm. When I first became a Christian back in the 1970s, there was a lot of emphasis back in those days on Bible prophecy and studying Bible prophecy and stuff, and it was exciting. It's really fallen out of favor in the last 20, 25 years. And as a result, many Christian churches have missed out on that quote-unquote blessed hope that Christ will return one day for his church, his bride, and that he will deal with the world, and that you know, we have a different future to look forward to after he returns. The things that we see in the world today are different than what we saw in the 1970s. In the 1970s, when IBM first introduced the scanner in a grocery store, oh my gosh, Christians freaked out. Oh, it's the mark of the beast. Oh, help. I'm not going to go through that food line. They're not going to scan my hand or my groceries or whatever. But there was all kinds of things people ran after back in those days that were really pretty ludicrous.
Do you think that that's contributed to the lack of interest in this kind of thing today?
There's just lack of interest today.
Yeah, but do you think that – is that because people in the past did just run after all these things rather perhaps uncritically?
I think the emerging church today around the world is actually telling parishioners not to study Bible prophecy, that it's a waste of time. And I think that's why people don't study it today. But from my point of view, and I've always had an interest in Bible prophecy, what we see happening in the world today is creating the kind of system that ultimately the Antichrist will be able to assume control over. And you remember, the Antichrist, we've always called him a dictator, but he's not called a dictator in the Bible. He's called the Antichrist. And really, the word anti is not quite right. It really says pseudo. He's a fake Christ. And as a spiritual leader, if you will, and perhaps as a statesman, it doesn't really call him a dictator, yet he is. We know conceptually he is a dictator because he's going to run the world himself and tell everybody what to do. But he can't be in all places at all times. And so how will this end time system actually be able to function and control the affairs of men with the specificity that we see in the book of Revelation? And I would contend today that if you look at technocracy and how it's set up to work, that it is setting up the perfect system that only needs a policymaker at the top to determine what will and won't happen in order to control people. You have control over energy, control over water, gas distribution as part of energy, location, like will you get on a train or not, or on a plane or not. It's all determined by the computer, not by you or not by man. It's something that can be completely automated from top to bottom, and nobody will have any recourse. There'll be nobody to call if you don't like a decision that's made. And I could go on with that whole paradigm, but I think there's incredible biblical significance here to what's going on today.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that does make a great deal of sense, what you've just sketched out there. However, it has to be said that looking at it like that, the easy reaction is to say, well, that is absolutely soul-destroying. You know, if that is prophesied to happen, it's going to happen, God has said it's going to happen, then what's the point in even opposing it in any way? It's going to happen. God knows it will happen.
Well, he does. He knows what's going to happen. We don't. We cannot predict a future, and I'm not predicting the future here. We can't presume that God will not turn the hands back on this whole process. He may. That's his sovereign choice to do that. But I would point back to the Christians that lived during the time of Hitler in Germany. As things were really getting heated up in Germany, is it conceivable that any Christian in those days didn't have thoughts that the end of the world was near? Maybe even Hitler was the Antichrist himself. I'm sure they thought, man, the only way out of this, we hope Christ comes soon. But, you know, he didn't. But on the other hand, Hitler was finally conquered, and the end of the world didn't happen. So I can see, I can put myself in those shoes today, in a sense, and say, well, it looks pretty grim, but nobody knows what the hand of God is going to do. And as a Christian, we have no right to put him in such a box, so he must act this way or that way. And so I think the mandate for Christians is to open your mouth, speak what you know, try and persuade. We have no right as Christians to retreat into the cave and just wait for the rocks to fall on our heads. We need to be out on the front line screaming this from the housetop, so to speak, and being salt and light like the Bible tells us we're supposed to be. In the meantime, this is a passionate thing that we do. It's always good to interact with people in the public forum. And for those that might see this as a downer, I'm sorry for them, but they can do some soul searching and figure out what to do about it. And they have answers. God will show them answers if they want them.
But I mean, ultimately, it isn't a downer, because at the end of the day, or at the end of the era, it's Christ who has the victory.
That's right. His victory is certain in the end. It's guaranteed, absolutely certain. We just don't know when. And I will say to Christians, I'll say this about, you know, everybody's talking about having a biblical worldview today. Well, I'll tell you what, you have to have, in order to have a biblical worldview, you have to have the Bible. You have to start with the Bible, for sure. But you can study the Bible all you want, but when you turn your glasses or your scope to the world, if you want to see the world through a biblical lens, you have to see the world for what it really is, not for what you think it is.
Well, I know exactly the kind of thing you mean, because in our church, the Bible is prized. There's no doubt about it. But there's a certain way of looking at the Bible which doesn't really take seriously the prophetic element. And so people are not really able to interpret the signs of the times. And, you know, when I preach, I do actually try to do some of that, but it doesn't go down very, you know, it's not very popular, I'm afraid.
Well, I know. And it's just, it's a wake up, it's kind of a wake up thing for Christians to see the world for as it really is, because they cannot have an accurate biblical worldview if they have some fantasy on what's going on in the world. And people do have fantasies what's going on in the world. In America, we, you know, most Americans think it's all about the people we elect to Congress. It's those congressmen, you know, it's those pesky senators or whatever that are screwing us up. They don't have a clue. By and large, they don't have a clue of what's really going on in the world today. Therefore, they could know the Bible as well as they want to know it, and that doesn't mean they're not going to have blessing in their life either, but if they want to have a biblical worldview, they're just spitting in the wind, thinking that they're gonna take a fantasy and make the Bible fit to it. It's not going to happen. Yeah, exactly. You understand what I'm saying?
Yes. It certainly has to be the other way. Yes, that has to be our interpretive framework provided by the Bible. Yeah,
that's right. You have to see reality as it really is. And the world today is so confusing to most people. And me, I'm confused too, still, to a great extent.
You don't sound at all confused to me, actually.
But, you know, when you look at things like technocracy and you look at things what the United Nations is doing, you look at sustainable development, you look at the Earth Charter, you look at all these things, the pattern of them, and you know darn well that these things didn't happen just by accident. They have been orchestrated on purpose for an end game in mind. And the Bible clearly says that there is one who is called the God of this world. That's the devil himself. He is the God of this world. And so who is orchestrating this world today? Who's the conductor of the orchestra? Well, according to the Bible, it's the devil himself. Why is he doing all this orchestrating? What's he orchestrating towards? Well, the Bible says that Christ is going to come one day, and that the Antichrist is going to assume control for that seven-year period, known as the tribulation period or the time of Jacob's trouble. And he will have full reign during that period to mount his last offensive against God. And it's going to be messy. Yes, it will. But he knows his time. I think he knows his time is short. And I would conjecture that he will not, of that seven-year period, I will conjecture that he will not spend 1 minute worrying about creating infrastructure things to control his world. I would conjecture he's going to do that in advance of that time period starting. Any good general, any good, you know, war strategist, whatever, knows that before you march to battle, you have all your ducks lined up in a row.
And there's no doubt that in your book, you do actually lay that out. You do actually provide evidence of this infrastructure being built that we see necessary to the fulfillment of that prophecy. That's not to say that what is actually happening will lead necessarily to that prophecy being fulfilled. We don't know when that's going to be, but it's consistent with it. And we need to take that seriously, that this could be, just could be the time when such a thing is fulfilled. And as you remind us, this is not something to be gloomy about, but to speak about in the knowledge that Christ will return and that his is the victory. And I do say to people again, this book has to be read. It's a very important book. As I've said many times, it joins so many of the dots, perhaps not all the dots. That would be too much to ask for, you know, for every question possible to be answered, but it makes a great deal of sense. And I do encourage people to get that and read it. Now, I understand that people can get it off Amazon, but they can get it directly from you. And if they get it from you, can they get a signed copy?
Well, yes, they can. They have to do that by going to technocracyrising.com. However, I have to say, if you live in Europe or you live outside of the United States, other than Canada, Canada's okay. But if you live outside the United States, the shipping charges are going to be fairly steep to ship from Arizona to or from the U.S. to your location. So you might want to check with Amazon, especially in Europe, just to see if you can get it there. They have printing facilities in Europe and usually can deliver the book within a day or two. And you do get a little bit cheaper, but if you want a signed copy, I'd be happy to do that. And if you want to buy bulk copies, I have a pretty steep discount schedule if people buy multiple copies, you know, like if they get up 20, 30, 40, 50 copies of it for whatever purpose, the price goes down dramatically. But it's $19.95 retail, and there's a Kindle version for people that like to read the electronic version. They can get the Kindle version from Amazon anywhere in the world at any time. Yeah. And have instant download. So you could do it, you know, 30 seconds after the show's over.
Absolutely. Well, why not?
That's right.
And so, it's cheaper, presumably, than the physical version.
It is. It's $9.95, actually, to get the Kindle version. So this is not a deal breaker in terms of money, for sure. But people will want to sit down with a highlighter and a pen, take notes and underline things and mark things. And another radio person told me that they ran their yellow highlighter out of ink by page 150.
I can believe that. Now, I don't use highlighters myself. I just use good old-fashioned pencil, but there's hardly a page here. I'm just flicking through it now without a mark on it. It's just incredible, the number of connections that were there. And disturbing read in some ways, but nevertheless a very profitable read. And I think there's no way I'm just going to read through that once. I've got to read through that at least once more, probably several times, I think, and I do recommend everybody does that. Thanks ever so much, Pat, for coming on the program. It's been a delightful and very fascinating conversation, and I'm very grateful to you for joining us again.
Oh, great. My pleasure, Julian. I hope we could do it again sometime.
Thank you ever so much for coming on.
You're entirely welcome.